welcome. This is William Evans here. You're listening to the second in a series of conversations with Brooke Levan. Welcome, Brooke.
Hey, Will, and hello, everybody.
Good to have you here.
It's a pleasure always to wander with you.
Okay. So tell me about the relationship that Rudolf Steiner had with Goethe.
Well, they lived at different times physically, but clairvoyantly, they were intimate. In his 20s, Rudolf Steiner was assigned, if I have this straight, to archive Goethe's library, personal notes and books and everything. And so he got pretty intimate with Goethe's thinking and being. And that had great influence on Steiner. And, you know, Steiner is Waldorf schools and biodynamics and anthroposophy and these thought ideas. And so,
and Goethe was, in one sense, a nature mystic.
Well, it's important to know history a little bit. Napoleon is going after the monarchy, and he's moving across Europe. And actually, some villages and towns welcomed him because they were fed up with the monarchy. And so this was, it's overshadowed by his emperor-type attitude, but I'm talking about Napoleon. But so this group, what Goethe attracted to a town called Jena, J-E-N-A, in Austria, Germany, somewhere, which was called the Holy Roman Empire. Of course, I think it was Voltaire who said it's not an empire and there's nothing holy about it, but that's what it was called on the map. It wasn't Germany yet. And so there's this great upheaval, another round, Europe has gone through so much. But so this was around that time in the late 1700s and early 1800s, 1802, 1804. And so at Jena, Goethe is already known. And they all had, what do you call it, patrons. They had counts and things, but they were also given freedom. And Jena was owned, or in part, and there was a university there that was funded or supported by more than one monarchy. So it was three or four, I forget how many. And so because of it, they could bounce around and hover in between them for support and keep the thinking free. And so out of here comes Hegel, Schelling, Scheller, onward. And so Novalis. And so this is a 10-year period, and this is the birth of, and it's only 10 years, of German Romanticism. In the West, growing up, I'm born in 56, so right after World War II, just about anything German was, what do you call it, demonized.
And that's why Schweitzer came to Aspen.
Well, okay.
Because
yes,
they wanted to put somebody in the public image other than Hitler as a representative of the German nation.
Yeah.
And they chose Goethe, and they asked Schweitzer to come deliver this memorial address.
Right.
And so...
good choice.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was all heavily under the auspices of the University of Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And they said the dilemma of our time is spiritual.
Yes, of course. And that's what the Romantics were saying. As material realism is building in Europe and in the West, and we, at founding of our country, post, indigenous, we leaned heavily on material realism. And everything in life is mechanical. And even human beings are machines. I mean, you went through conventional medical training. Weren't you taught that we are basically machines?
Oh, I had a National Geographic book entitled that, The Incredible Machine.
Wow.
And it was an amazing experience for me to be treated with acupuncture.
Yeah.
At the same time, go to Switzerland and hear Jonas Salk say we need schools of health in addition to schools of medicine.
Instead of schools of disease.
And we need schools of health and learn how to evoke and maintain a healthy balance.
Mm-hmm.
And so I knew from my experience with acupuncture that this guy knew how to do things I didn't know how to do.
As a healer.
And so I went to acupuncture school and rebuilt my head. And the professor was in love with the spiritual aspect of every point.
Yeah.
So every lecture would be, this is the most important, most beautiful point in the whole body.
Right.
And the next one was the same.
Yeah.
But it was a different point.
Each one would fire something different in the being.
Yes. Yeah. In the whole being. And being is very different than doing.
Yeah.
Or having. I did a lot of doing. I have a lot of stuff. And learning how to be is like waking up, because being has a spiritual dimension.
Yeah, we're all busy every day doing. And part of what we're teaching out in the seminars and that we're doing now at the ranch are being and doing are critical. But we have to know who we are first, be. Otherwise, we're going to just keep doing the same thing and making the same mistakes. And we don't understand how effective we can be once we have, you know, centered ourselves and found our authentic selves, because we work from a very different place when we do that. Yeah. Just that I know Blake and Emerson, you know, the British and the American romantics were great. And that's what we got. But it wasn't until I was maybe 40, 45 that I heard about Goethe. In fact, the spelling, I said Goethe, G-O-E-T-H. I didn't even know how to pronounce. But I had no background in German Romanticism in any of my conventional public and or special other education. I had to really go out and look for that, because of how I was colonized after World War II.
I got to get immersed in that. I went to the University of Vienna for a year.
Yeah. Well.
And I read Goethe. I read it in English, but got immersed in it.
But you had to go look for it because it wasn't in our school books.
No, and, you know, we were giving our American version to what Goethe was saying.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, Krishnamurti said, you think you're thinking your own thoughts, but you're really thinking your culture's thoughts. So we have been totally colonized, and we don't even get it. It's in our language, it's in how we're thinking, it's in everything, and it's constantly, and we're bombarded by it every day. And so the work we're trying to do now is help people reexamine that and find their own and trust themselves again. Yeah. Yeah. So it's about a radical reverence, and that's what so we maybe are neo-romantics now. I don't know. I don't like titles and isms, but we're embracing science, yes, mathematics, okay. But they have found there are no constants, as much as they would like to have constants and hypothetically base most of their thinking and their theories on the idea of constants. We're in an ever-moving, flowing dynamic. And they say molecules in the universe will fall apart if they're not in constant. But if they're fixed, that's when they break down.
So Schweitzer had a career in Europe, went to Africa as a missionary, was going up a river, medically make a visit to a wife of a colonizing executive, and the boat was going upstream and it went through a herd of hippopotamuses. Mm. And Schweitzer had this awakening that his philosophy was one of reverence for life.
Yeah. What are those epiphanies? People have them, but like we talked earlier or in another session, sometimes it takes us a while to decode the experiences, to see the connections and the patterns that connect.
What is the place of reverence for life in your worldview and in your current work?
It's in me. And it's my responsibility to hone that. I'm a conduit.
And so
keep it sharp, awake.
So you
responsive.
Use your fire. Yeah. You use your fire in alignment with reverence for life.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of discussion these days about law of attraction. I have an opinion about that. I don't think that that's the way to go. I think we have to take charge of our experience and use our fire and our will to take charge of our experience again. Because we've given it up. We've let it been taken from us. It's on our watch. It's our fault. But it's relentless out there. And I get why people just kind of, you know, they take a long neck bud on the couch with the Sunday game and they're, you know, that's what their whole goal is. And they work for the weekend and they instead of their evolutionary being.
Can you say anything about your aliveness with reverence for life?
My aliveness with reverence for life. It's a high. I'm kind of constantly steeped in gladness. The dialogue is rich. I think this is not for everybody. I don't know. Maybe it is. I think anybody can do it. But it is careful what you wish for. All of a sudden, you start hearing everybody, all of the life, talking, you know. Wemagua, the rivers, the slopes, you know, the animals.
What are they saying?
And the plants. Well, they're initially saying, thank you for coming by. We miss you all, you know. So that dialogue is, you know.
Once you've made the acknowledgement.
So that's what we teach to is they're, you know, first we acknowledge the life and then we ask and dialogue and then we thank. So those are three basic steps. First, we acknowledge, hello, how are you? And we get a response.
And then you.
Then we ask
listen. Or
dialogue and listen.
Listen.
That's right. We listen, but we also use our fire and say, how can we help this? How can we reclaim balance and harmony again? Because we've thrown it off. And so farming isn't natural, right? Ranching isn't natural. And so building a town and putting a Cartesian grid of roads and slapping that on a fractal brilliance kills vitality or throws it out of balance. And so it's our job, and we can do it, is to bring back into balance our homes, our lives, our relationships with everything and each other.
Well, you must have been in awe that there were people in Africa who were large-scale potters that create a village, a compound, a home, multiple homes in a spiral, and then had this amazing relationship with all of the creation that they would know how to protect and energize within that oval room.
And speak with.
And be in constant communication.
Yeah.
And relationship.
And also acknowledging, asking, and thanking.
Yeah.
They were asking for a good crop. They were asking for protection from the evil tree spirits or whatever their conceptions were, you see. And they were in, but everything was alive. The buildings were born, like we experienced the early work in the building activity. And in 6 months, we saw this massive earthen spiraling compound. And it moved into an adolescent period. So the buildings were alive. And then we visited other neighboring compounds that were being painted by the women and celebrated by particular patterns because they had gone through initiation and they had gone into maturity. And so when I got back to the States, I came back to our buildings and I was astounded in coming from that much integrity and dialogue with the structures, for instance, and the materials and their understanding. I came back and I applied for art school to teach in art schools. And I went into the studios that were made of concrete block and spattered paint and, you know, popcorn ceilings and fluorescent lighting. And I went, this is where we think creativity is going to be born. You know, it was talk about culture shock.
What a blessing to be where you are now.
Yeah.
Well, and alive under the mountain.
I am daily grateful to have that terrible view and those and nothing else to look at and to communicate with. Yeah, I know that it's been so rich.
And you have your own version of that little building.
Well, we have had opportunities to include design dynamics, geometries, and intentions that enliven our workspaces and our living spaces. And so if we are going to renovate and or build something new, we incorporate things that, you know, wouldn't necessarily go on to a county permitting because they don't care about how you arrange, you know, the flooring or the siding or even hidden underlying geometries in the landscape. For them, it's buildings and, you know, they have their reasons to help us with their code and zoning. But these are elements or things we can add, intentions that we can incorporate into our buildings that actually build a frequency and a healing network instead of just our purely economic, mechanistic reasons, you know, get in and get out, make your money, the builder and the designer, architect, and give the client their thing and, you know, time is money kind of thing. But to build something that's holy, that's sacred. And we have that opportunity all around us every day. We are surrounded by opportunities to engage.
Yeah, more opportunities than I can possibly fathom.
That's right.
And I'm sorting all the time to try and stay on track.
That's all we can do.
Now, you see your purpose as standing tall and healing with the fire of your intention. A lot of the population sees their purpose as to be obedient to the rules, and they would rather be right than healthy.
Yeah. Well, I'm less interested in being understood and more interested in understanding. So what did Rumi say? There's a outside of right doing and wrongdoing, there is a field, and I will meet you there.
Yeah, he basically said beyond wrongdoing and right doing,
yeah,
there is a field. I will meet you there.
Right on.
And that's the magical place, isn't it?
Yeah, the space between things. Yeah. I've always questioned the rules. I've been called the, oh, you're not a rule follower. But then I see the people who obey and follow the rules, and maybe in that they can find it. I don't know. But I have to question it and find my own track. Yeah.
And you've been doing that all your life?
For a long time. That's why the art box, the artist box, gave me the most elbow room when I was 5 or 6. And I stayed in there, and I could dance, and I could question the inquiry.
So you've always been an artist?
I guess so, yeah. Yeah. I mean, somebody asked me the other day, so I met David Abrams, you know, who wrote Spell
think?
Of the Sensuous.
Yeah, what did you think?
And we just talked briefly, but he said, so, brother, what do you do? Who are you? And I didn't know what to say. I said, David, I'm going to fall back on, I guess right now I'm a biodynamic farmer. But he seemed to know that that was big, that there was a lot there. So that worked then. But
Amory really likes him.
Yeah, David's special. He's got a new book out too. I forget the name of it. But
did you get it?
I did. Yeah. So anyway, there are those that are out there in that field, and they're for me the interesting ones. I tell the younger people, I say, look, I have very few regrets, but there are some people that have been important for me in their books and their talks or whatever, or in knowing them or whatever, but those who I didn't go get to know. And so I tell the younger ones, I said, if you are moved by someone's being or teaching or whatever, go there and sweep their floor. And it will be 6 months or a year, big deal. You're young. And don't take no for an answer. Show up every morning before they show up at their studio or their office or whatever, and be waiting for them. And they will take you, because it's very rare that a younger person is that eager to learn from somebody. So sweep their floor, do whatever it takes, and they will let you in to other levels, and the gains are immeasurable. I'm interested in apprenticeship and mentorship, internship, way more. I did academia, and the programmed structure of it, I do not recommend for most. I advised students when I was teaching, and the administration was not very happy. But some would meet some kids, and I'd go, get out of here. It's good for some.
Briefly touch on what happened in China when you got into the boat building business and traveling rivers.
Well, I collect rivers. It's pretty handy. They don't take up a lot of space in your memory and in your experience. And so the Nile, went to climb the mountains of the moon and ruined Zoris between Zaire, now Congo, and Uganda, and then followed the Nile north, a bunch of things like that. And so going to the source was physically, I found, to be powerful. So we climbed the three major peaks, the glacial peaks of the ruined Zoris. And China was another opportunity to go up onto the Tibetan Plateau, which, by the way, is the source of most of the holy rivers in Asia. So, you know, the Ganges, and you name them. They start upon the plateau above 15,000 feet. And so Rose and Cooper was five and turned six, our eldest. We went to the source and drank from the glacial melt of the Yellow River. And we wanted to understand China. And they call the Yellow Huanghe, the Yellow River, they call it the mother of China. So we thought, well, let's go learn that river and learn from that river. And so we started up there and followed it out, building boats, traditional river craft, along the way as a practice and as a means for them to teach us, instead of building like the huts and compounds in Ghana. It was to build river craft. And so the first one was 14 goats, skin raft with sapling frame. And they taught us how to, what woods to harvest and how to lash things and also how to harvest the goats and their hides so that they would become inflatables. And so these take weeks to build. And then we shoot the river, which is mostly uncharted by our thinking. But they had stories about the river and about the double dragon rapids. And they had, the tiger, da-da-da. They had all these names. And they were fierce sections of the river. But the first part was in the Tibetan Plateau, and there was not navigable. So we drank from the glacial melt, and we went with Tibetan yak trains, and we slept in the black yak wool tents with them, and they took us in. I wonder how we would be if someone knocked on our door, and said, "Hey, I want to study you," and you'd go, "Get the hell out of here, kid." I don't know, but they were, everywhere we went, they are these indigenous, essentially, people, right, have welcomed us, and we didn't come to teach them. We came to learn from them and to listen. And I think that was different for them, for most. I don't know.
Thank you, Brooke.
Yeah.
This is KDNK, and we've been talking with Brooke Levan again. Thank you for listening.